all the tourists aren't here yet. So I think we got a couple of weeks before it really starts to impact us quite a bit.
The FAA furloughs hit Alaska at a fortunate time. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an update on an 800-mile trek with two toddlers.
When you have 25-knot winds and temperatures in the teens with a little blowing snow, it is just too cold to be out walking with the kids.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Alaska travelers aren't experiencing the delays that lower 48 travelers are because of air traffic controller furloughs. Yesterday marked the first day of the furloughs, which are part of the Federal Aviation Administration's plan to cut 5% from their budget as a result of sequestration. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
The air traffic controller furloughs are arriving at a fortunate time for Alaska. Steve Monroe is the regional vice president for the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
All the tourists aren't here yet. The float planes aren't flying. There's not a lot going on out in the bush that's related to summertime activities. So I think we got a couple of weeks before it really starts to impact us quite a bit.
When the number of flights begins to increase as summer draws closer, Monroe anticipates staffing numbers to remain roughly the same as they are for the winter flight schedules, and that could create some problems. Pilots in rural areas may experience occasional delays due to some staffing cuts at flight service stations, which provide information on weather advisories, equipment, and whatever else the pilots need. But Monroe expects the majority of the issues to pertain to flights in and around Anchorage.
I don't think you'll see delays once you're outside the bowl area. Most of the delays are going to come in this controlled airspace where the Anchorage Tower has to talk to you.
Until sequestration ends, air traffic controllers will have to take one furlough day every 2 weeks. Monroe says they are trying to spread those days out as much as possible to minimize impacts on air travel. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
If you watched the season premiere of Deadliest Catch last week, you might have noticed a line in the credits acknowledging the Alaska Film Office's contribution to the show. It wasn't just a reference to the fact that the show is filmed in Alaska. The note was included because the state actually subsidizes the popular reality television series through its film tax credit program. A bill getting rid of the program stalled in the legislature this year, but lawmakers are planning to push it during next year's session. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
The Alaska Film Production Incentive was created by the state legislature in 2008 to do exactly what its name suggests, encourage film production in Alaska. Dave Worrell runs the program for the state.
Really, British Columbia was one of the first to effectively utilize an incentive program, and that's one of the reasons they have become essentially Hollywood North. So many productions took advantage of their incentive that they were really able to build that industry from basically nothing. And so a lot of other jurisdictions, U.S. states, looked at that as a model and said, boy, we want our part too.
The way Alaska's program works, production companies keep track of how much they spend on payroll, food, lodging, and transportation while in the state, and then submit the totals to the film office. Worrell then uses those figures to calculate and issue tax credits, which the production companies convert into cash by selling to Alaskan companies with corporate tax liability.
And typically they will sell that tax credit at some sort of a discount. That can range between 70 and 90 cents on the dollar.
Original Productions declined to comment on the tax credits, and the figures for this season of Deadliest Catch aren't publicly available. But for season 8, the company received $700,000 from the state, or 96% of their production costs, excluding non-resident wages. Of that, $7,000, or roughly 1%, went to wages for Alaskan residents. Critics point to those kind of numbers as cause for concern. Representative Bill Stoltz, a Republican from Chugiak, introduced a bill in the state legislature this year asking for an end to the program. In testimony at the House Commerce and Labor Committee, he said it simply doesn't pencil out.
If we're paying for something, I like to make sure it's working, functionary, and really does have the benefits at a good cost-benefit ratio.
Before renewing the program's funding last year, the state legislature requested an audit to answer the cost-benefit question. The audit found that for every dollar spent on the subsidy, it generated $2 in economic benefits. But Stoltz said in his testimony that the state is in worse financial shape than it was last year and suggested the money would be better spent elsewhere or not at all.
I would be happy with stopping the bleeding before, we still have a good blood flow.
Stoltz's bill to repeal the tax credit was still in committee when the legislature gaveled out, but it will be back on the agenda during next year's session. Whatever the outcome of House Bill 112, Deadliest Catch fans shouldn't worry. While Original Productions has accepted the proffered subsidy, the show was filming in Alaska long before the tax credit program came into existence. And if the 3.4 million people who tuned into the season premiere are any indication, that isn't about to change. In Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Two bodies were found on separate fishing vessels in two Kodiak harbors on Friday. Police Chief T.C. McKamai says there were no signs of trauma on either body, leading some to speculate they may be drug-related. But Kamai said that can't be confirmed until a toxicology screening is complete. The men who died are 44-year-old David Babarovich and Thaddeus Zaboyliak, Jr., age 41. Kamai says both bodies have been sent to the state medical examiner's office for a full autopsy. He says preliminary causes of death could be released within a few days. Kamai says nothing leads him to believe the deaths were related, and at this time, the police department is approaching them as two separate investigations. Alaska State Troopers report a Pitkus Point man died over the weekend in a snow machine accident. KYUK's Mark Earhart reports.
On Saturday, Troopers spokesperson Beth Ibsen says 37-year-old Daryl Hunt was traveling along the Andrevsky River on a 2013 Ski-Doo snow machine when he was fatally injured.
It came to a right-hand curve in the river, and instead of going on the trail and turning around the curve, he went straight off the trail and went for about 200 yards and then hit about 4 feet tall cut bank.
Hunt was leading two others on a single snow machine on a caribou hunting trip. The accident happened about 52 miles up the North Fork of the Andrevsky.
When the two others on the other snow machine came upon him, he was unresponsive, wasn't talking, wasn't breathing, so they performed CPR on him for about 15 to 20 minutes. And when that wasn't successful, they wrapped him in a tarp, put him on the sled that Daryl had been towing, and then rode back to St. Mary's.
St. Mary's is located about 5 miles northeast of Pitkus Point. Hunt was pronounced deceased upon arrival. He was reportedly traveling upwards of 45 miles per hour at the time of the crash. But Ibsen says Hunt's snow machine was not badly damaged.
There was a bent bar in the back and just some general, scrapes on the snow machine. You know, the brakes worked, the steering was fine. You know, the lack of damage is also puzzling, too. So, because he hit the bank and really, that was it.
Ibsen says troopers are still unclear as to why Hunt drove straight into the cut bank. The two men with Hunt did say they had previously stopped and consumed alcohol. Troopers will not know if Hunt was intoxicated at the time of his death until a toxicology report is filed. His body was sent to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for an autopsy. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, jobs are on the line in Sitka with necessary school budget cuts.
They're your neighbors. They're your friends. They're people that you've known for a long time, and it doesn't make it easy in any way, shape, or form.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership and business industries across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message is sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
A group of about 40 people held a rally in Bethel this morning for subsistence rights. They gathered in the parking lot of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game Office. Most of them were Yupik from Bethel and nearby villages. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes was there and has the story.
Tim Andrew, who organized the event, pulls protest signs out of a pickup truck.
This has been building for quite a few years.
Andrew says he's been thinking about this day for a long time. A way to peacefully protest state management that has been conflicting with Yupik hunters and fishermen for decades. A large, colorful sign reads, "Feeding our families is not a crime."
and the fishermen trials are clearly on people's minds. Nick Hoover, who is from the village of Kosigluk, says that's why he's here.
To support, you know, the fishers, the protest fishers from last year. I have been keeping tabs on them, and I just think it's important to show them support.
Others also talk about the fishermen who were sighted last summer during subsistence closures. But for Andrew, the rally is about something much bigger than a trial.
It's people from primarily from Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and the Kenai Peninsula that are controlling our way of life, our access to our fisheries, our access to our way of access to game.
So politics are getting in the way?
Yes, very much so.
As people continue to arrive, most ralliers are timidly facing one another in the parking lot until one woman gives them some friendly encouragement.
Face the road so people can see you.
Her name is Monica Sheldon, and she holds a sign that reads, "Fish equals culture."
My sign means that the fish that we fish for, the salmon especially, and any kind of fish actually, is the food that we live on and gives us strength and helps us to sustain our way of life.
Andrew gets out a small microphone to address the crowd.
Welcome, Koyanapiti Dailiji, to the Idle No More subsistence rally.
With mic in hand, he leads the group in a march to the Bethel Courthouse via Bethel's main road. They stop at Watson's Corner and wave their signs at the traffic passing by.
People make a noise.
At the courthouse, a single drum is heard as several people take turns speaking in support of subsistence rights. Akiak tribal leader Mike Williams Sr. says there is a need for tribal co-management of resources.
Our people have managed our resources for over 10,000 years. We've done a pretty good job, and that's a pretty good track record. And our people, our tribal governments, must be afforded on a government-to-government basis with the federal government, and that is the federal law. But the state needs to honor that as well.
Who believes in subsistence?
Yeah!
Who believes in fishing?
Yeah!
Who believes in gathering?
It's been about an hour and a half, and as the crowd leaves, Andrew says he thinks it went well. He says subsistence supporters need to continue to express their rights to the state government management groups.
You know, because all those people control how we eat, when we eat, and how we hunt, how we gather, how we fish.
Andrew says oftentimes those regulations and enforcement practices go against the Yupik culture and traditional way of life. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
The difficulties of living in rural Alaska are well known. Limited access to health care, expensive goods, slow internet. But what about the difficulties of dying there? Rural communities are known for supporting family members after the death of a loved one. As part of our series looking at culture in Alaska, Ann Hillman went to Pilot Station near Bethel and learned how one community helps its residents.
According to the Pilot Station Traditional Council, in 2011, community members spent more than $764,000 on bingo, pull tabs, and raffle tickets. After paying out prizes and buying supplies, the tribe had $57,000 left for the Community Support Fund. They use that money to help families pay for medical bills, unexpected expenses, and funeral costs. Mayor and Tribal Council member Abraham Kelly says, the death brings the community together.
We comfort a family for 40 days. As a community, we bring food to the family. The whole community brings food and support, and we help each other out by food, a lot of food.
But they also support each other's decisions, even if they're unconventional.
Did you say hi? Yeah.
Palasa Bean sits with her granddaughter at the kitchen table.
She's really quiet. She's just trying to be shy.
Beans was shy, too, when she first met her future husband at a dance about 30 years ago.
Well, I couldn't believe he existed because I dreamt about him when I was 10, when I lived in Aniak.
She was 14 when she met Bruce in Pilot Station.
When did you finally get the courage to talk to him?
When I was 16.
What did you say? Do you remember?
I think I'll keep that private.
They were married for nearly 25 years when he died in 2010.
He was going up to our fish camp to light the smokehouse, and he probably hit something underwater and got thrown out of a boat and drowned.
Her husband was alone the day he died, and no one saw exactly what happened. When he didn't return home after about 36 hours, his son and nephew went out to look for him. They found his empty boat. Searchers dragged the river the next day and pulled up his body. Typically, if a person dies unexpectedly and without witnesses, the body must be sent to the medical examiner's office in Anchorage. State medical examiner Catherine Raven explains that her role is to make sure the family and the state know the exact cause of death.
You have to have someone who's qualified, who has a medical background, to determine, does this look like a poisoning? Is this a gunshot wound? We've had several cases that have come in as drownings that have been homicides. We've had several cases come in as naturals that have been homicides. We've had several cases come in as homicides that were naturals.
She says that families are more likely to request an examination than to refuse it. Having bodies examined can also reduce public health risks. If a person dies of a contagious disease, the examiner will catch it and make sure everyone in contact with that person is treated.
There is a reason there's a coroner medical examiner system in place. It's a huge reason. And without that, and by not having cases come in and looked at and approved, and it's going back, we'd be going back really to medieval times.
Raven says it's just not possible to have medical examiners at all of the regional hubs. When the examiner's office requests a body to be sent to Anchorage, they will pay for the transport costs to and from the place of death. That didn't matter to Palasa Beans. She refused to let her husband be removed from the village.
But just think of the pain of how you have lost your loved one, and to put on top of that if they had to take him away.
Though community members were told by the state troopers not to wash his body or to move it back to Beans' home, they decided to support her decision. And when the medical examiner could not issue a death certificate without seeing the body, the tribal council decided to design and issue its own.
We agreed that it didn't have to look exactly like a state death certificate, but, we have witnesses sign that saw his body, that he was gone.
Pilot Station is the first tribe to create its own death certificate. It is not recognized as a legal document by any state or federal agencies. That means it can't be used for collecting insurance payments or Social Security. Beans got around some of those limitations by using the police report in place of an official death certificate. A statement issued by Alaska's legal department says that they cannot recognize tribally issued death certificates because a body needs to be examined by a medical professional. But whatever the legal issues, in Pilot Station, it's just one more way to support a community member through the death of a loved one. For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership in business industries across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
School districts across the state are struggling with budget cuts. In Sitka, the school board is taking public testimony tonight on next year's budget. The board is planning to spend more than two-thirds of its savings to help patch a deficit, but it still has nearly $400,000 to make up, and layoffs are likely. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
Open swim at the only pool in Sitka. A handful of people have trickled in just before noon. Pool manager Jane Eidler has been here since 7 a.m.
I came into work one day and I got a phone call from one of the secretaries at Baranoff, who said to me, "Jane, did you know that your job is on the line?" And I said, "What job?" And she said, "Your job."
The pool is inside Blatchley Middle School, and Eidler is second on a list of potential cuts the school district could make to balance its budget. Upon hearing that, She made a list of her own.
There are 55 things that I do that I came up with.
Number one is scheduling events. Number three is checking the pool chemicals every day. Number 12 is administering swimming competency tests required to graduate from the school district. Managing lifeguards, keeping the storeroom stocked, handling money and billing, managing lost and found. And number 55, troubleshoot anything that comes up.
I'm overwhelmed by the thought that all this is going to go down by the wayside.
It's worth noting that the school board has not decided one way or another on any of the proposed cuts, but they also have not found any extra sources of funding. The legislature did not raise the per student amount of money school districts get, although there is some extra funding to handle school security. So the list of cuts is still on the table. At the top of that list is the high school activities director, then Idler's job, and then the community schools sports coordinator position. After that, a contract position that calls substitute teachers when they're needed, a halftime reading coach at Baranoff Elementary, the entire middle school shop program, and at the bottom of the list, two elementary school teachers. Altogether, the list adds up to just more than $500,000 in reductions.
Well, it's really uncomfortable. I mean, nobody wants to have to make those kinds of decisions.
Lon Garrison is president of the Sitka School Board.
We try not to make it a personal issue at all, but you know those people, you know. They're your neighbors. They're your friends. They're people that you've known for a long time, and it doesn't make it easy in any way, shape, or form.
Garrison says the idea is to make initial cuts as far away from the academic classroom as possible. That's why the two elementary teachers are at the bottom of the list. But he also says Sitka wants to educate the whole student. It wants to offer programs that extend beyond the regular academic subjects, things that improve a student's experience at school or build skills they can use throughout life. That said, Garrison adds that state and federal mandates are pretty clear about the standards school districts need to meet.
Generally, those standards are in language arts, you know, reading, math, now science, those academic areas. And so those end up, you know, kind of being the priority areas that you're going to have to think about making sure that you protect.
Sitka Mayor Mim McConnell says the health of a school district has impacts beyond the walls of a school building. To her, it's about a community's overall economy and quality of life. McConnell's own children are now grown with kids of their own.
When they move, they're checking to see what the schools are like. That's one of the main criteria for what town they're going to go to.
Back at the pool, some people are swimming laps and others are moving gently through the water on the other side. Idler has been full-time manager here for about 7 years, but has worked at the pool in some capacity since moving to Sitka in 1976. She seems calm at the prospect of losing her job.
I feel that this is the decision, then so be it. I'm not going to get stressed out about it. I am a person that believes in myself. I'll get something else.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The Higman-McKittrick family from Seldovia is making progress on their 800-mile journey around Cook Inlet. The family stopped by KBBI's studios in Homer last week and visited with Aaron Selbig.
Brentwood Higman and his wife Erin McKittrick looked a little worn when they arrived in Homer earlier this week, fresh off a hiking trip around Ketchumak Bay from Seldovia. After a short layover, however, they were ready to pack up and continue onward. Although the family has taken on long adventures before, including a two-month trek across Malaspina Glacier last year, Higman says he wasn't exactly sure how the children, 4-year-old Katmai and 1-year-old Latuya, would fare on this trip.
We weren't sure what it'd be like to be pack rafting with the kids. Latuya's changed a lot since the last trek she was on. We weren't sure how that was going to go. We weren't sure we were going to be able to fit everything in our pack. And all those things have really actually worked out pretty well. You know, we were a little surprised by the little winter blizzard we had about a week ago, but it's been going really, really good.
The family is making its way by both walking and pack rafting on a pair of small inflatable rafts that they carry in their pack. Higman says that sometimes the weather makes it difficult to do either.
When you have 25 knot winds and temperatures in the teens with a little blowing snow, it is just too cold to be out walking with the kids. overall, it's been, it's been something we've been very conscious of all along, making sure the kids are warm enough, but it's been very possible.
McKittrick talks about moving at Katmai pace, meaning the family walks only as fast as Katmai's legs can carry him. But Katmai pace, she says, has so far turned out to be a good pace for all of them.
It's fine. I mean, if you have your schedule set up that way and you're not expecting, if you're not expecting to be fast, there's actually a lot of interesting things you notice. And in fact, I really appreciated the chance to actually see the beaches and the bluffs coming into Homer, because every other time I've walked them, I've been like at the end of a trip and kind of like, okay, let's just get into Homer and get home.
For Katmai, the most exciting aspects of the trek are occasionally finding fossils and more often seeing wildlife.
When we saw the moose walking across the road.
You saw a moose walking across the road?
It was a female and big, but we were kind of far away from it, so it looked very small.
Oh. Did you see any other animals on your trip?
Yes, sea otters.
You saw sea otters?
Seals. And a giant plesiosaurus still around a gate called Plesiosaurus giganteus.
Plesiosaurus giganteus, huh?
Since plesiosaurs went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous period, it's not likely Katmai actually saw one of those. But Mom and Dad confirmed that there were indeed plenty of moose, otters, and seals around Ketchumak Bay. Even little Latuya is having fun on the trip. Although she spends much of the time riding with Mom in a sling, she says her favorite part so far is chasing bubbles on the beach.
I did bubbles to bubbles.
You did? You went did bubbles to bubbles?
The family spent a couple of days in Homer before departing from Bishop's Beach Tuesday afternoon. In town, they were able to take care of some logistical issues, including arranging supply drops on the remote western side of Cook Inlet. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Ann Hillman in Pilot Station, Ed Ronco in Sitka, Brianna Gibbs in Kodiak, Mark Earhart and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Register now for the 2013 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, May 2nd and 3rd at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. This fifth annual conference offers participants an unmatched opportunity to network with national industry experts and learn the latest on policies, programs, and projects in the clean energy industry. Online registration ends on April 26th. More information at www.bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.